Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does a president's personal life play into his performance as a leader? The marriage of Abraham Lincoln and Mary Todd Lincoln has fascinated Americans since the couple was in the White House. No less talked about it in its day than the relationships of the Clintons, the Reagans, or the Kennedys, Abraham Lincoln's marriage has long been perceived as a thoroughly burdensome relationship for the Civil War president. We think of Abe as saintly, Mary as unstable, and their time together as overwhelmingly marked by sorrow. But biographer Daniel Mark Epstein has uncovered new information that challenges those very simplistic assumptions and forces readers to consider multiple dimensions of the Lincolns' 22 years together. Daniel Mark Epstein's new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. Daniel, welcome to Think.
Chris, it's a pleasure to be on a program called Think.
Good
I really
to know.
Like that whole concept.
Thank you very much. We should start with this. The Lincolns were very much a couple drawn together by love. Abe fell head over heels for Mary Todd.
That's right, and I believe that this is one of the first books that that talks about the romance of the early years of the marriage. And they met. He was in his early 30s, and she was about 23 years old, and they immediately fell in love. They had a lot of things in common. They both loved poetry, and they could recite Byron and Byron and Burns and other favorite poets. And politics also drew them together. They were both imbued with the spirit of a party that we don't know much about these days, but it was the liberal party of that day called the Whigs. They were both Whigs.
And she had had a decent education. Her family was wealthy.
Yes, she was from Lexington, Kentucky, and actually extraordinarily well educated for a woman of her generation. Lincoln, of course, had almost no formal education, was almost completely self-taught. But I think each of them admired the intellectual capacities of the other. They're both quite witty. They're both skillful at repartee and jokes. So they also shared a sense of humor.
You write about Abraham Lincoln at one point. Everybody knew him and nobody did. Was that also true of his wife?
Oh, I think that Mary Lincoln was much more of an extrovert. Although it's kind of hard to use those terms and project those back onto the 19th century. But I think that Mary Lincoln was very, very expressive of her emotions. She was she had a very tempestuous sort of personality, and she said what was on her mind. This was both an advantage in certain of her relationships, but as she got older and, of course, was in a position of enormous responsibility as First Lady, then her openness and her candor often got her into trouble.
Well, you talk about projecting terms back into the 19th century. You seem to feel there's a danger in sort of over-pathologizing the Lincolns. In other words, we love now to look at them and say, well, clearly she was bipolar and clearly he was depressed. And maybe there was that makes it too easy to dismiss what went on between them.
Well, that's really my feeling about it. And I think the greatest challenge that I had when I started writing this book was to try to avoid any sort of stereotypes or generalizations, because those things often get in the way of really perceiving the facts. And I felt that my responsibility was to tell the story from the very beginning. Remember, these people were married for 22 years, to tell the entire story of the marriage without projecting onto any part of it the problems of another part. For instance, If you look at Mary Lincoln 10 years after the marriage was over, and you find out that she was committed to Bellevue Sanatorium in Illinois and spent 3 months there, if you look at that Mary Lincoln and you project that Mary Lincoln onto the young woman that Abraham Lincoln married, you're going to get the whole story wrong, because you're going to think Lincoln married a mad woman and who made his life a living hell. But that wasn't the case at all. They had wonderful, wonderful years together, particularly before they got to the White House.
Yeah, and in fact, you say you deliberately stopped the story essentially right after the assassination, because the widow Mary Lincoln had nothing to do with the woman who had been married to Abraham Lincoln.
I felt that was virtually true. I did spend a few paragraphs talking about the tragedy of Mary Lincoln after the assassination. We all know that she really never recovered psychologically from that trauma, or from the death of her her son Willie in the White House in 1862. She became a very, very tragic figure, and I wanted to avoid the reader projecting that Mary Lincoln onto the woman that Abraham Lincoln married.
They broke up quite suddenly after they had been seeing each other in 1840, I guess. And speculation was never really satisfactory as to what might have happened, especially given that they eventually reconciled. But you made a discovery that seems to explain what happened.
Well, it's been a mystery. Mystery for many, many years that people have kind of tiptoed around. What happened was they were engaged in the autumn of 1840 after knowing each other for not a very long time, and they broke up just before Christmas. And they reconciled 2 years later and got married on a few hours' notice. So there's that period where the two of them are apart. They're not speaking. They're not really communicating. And there have been all sorts of speculation about what happened. And I discovered a good deal of evidence that Lincoln broke off the engagement because he feared that he had syphilis. The main source of this information is William Herndon, his law partner, who said that Lincoln had confessed to him that he had gotten syphilis in 1838 from a woman in Beardstown, Illinois. And The other really significant piece of information is that during those 2 years, when he was separated, when he was postponing his engagement, or rather he'd broken off his engagement, he was taking blue mass pills. And blue mass pills are virtually elemental mercury, which in those days, because of its antibacterial effect, it was the treatment of choice for syphilis. And I believe that after taking the elemental mercury for 2 years, his symptoms disappeared, and he went back to Mary and felt that he could marry her then.
Was she pregnant at the time she married him?
Oh, we don't know. There's been a lot of speculation about that. She did give birth less than 9 months, about a week less than 9 months after they were married, so there was a lot of gossip over it. And they did rush to the altar. They announced in the morning that they would get married in the evening, and the family all gathered round, and they got the ginger beer and the cake and everything, and gathered the bride's groom, the bridegroom and the bridesmaids and everything, and put on a wedding. But it was really a last minute thing.
And not 48 hours after that wedding, Abe Lincoln left to go out of town.
Yes, it was kind of like being married to a sea captain. Mary had to endure long, long periods when Lincoln was on the road. When he married her, he was in debt. And they were living in a boarding house.
A tavern, right?
Beg your pardon.
It was attached to a tavern.
It was right. It was the Globe Tavern, and they lived in a room above the tavern. But he was on the circuit for months at a time. I think at one point I estimated that during the 17 years they lived in Springfield, he was gone probably a third of the time.
And how did she cope with that separation?
Well, she had some help in the house. After they left the Globe Tavern, he began making a little more money for a while. They even had a cousin of Lincoln's who lived with them and helped take care of the children. But I think it was a very hard life for her. Eventually, they had four children. They never had four children all at once because two of them died. But it was a hard life for a woman in those days. They didn't have, of course, washing machines and dryers and dishwashers and a lot of the things that we take for granted in terms of running a household. Mary Lincoln handled very, very skillfully. Including the sewing. She was a marvelous seamstress, and she made all of the children's clothes. She made Lincoln's shirts. She made the bed linens. This is a very high-functioning lady.
And she, in fact, had been raised with a great deal more luxury than she had, particularly in the early years of her marriage. Was that an issue for them?
Well, certainly, one of the problems when they're recording is that Lincoln believed, although she never mentioned this at all, I think that Lincoln believed that he was marrying over his head, over his station, in terms of, people were a little bit more class conscious then than they are today. And she had been raised in a mansion in Lexington, Kentucky, which was a really beautiful kind of upper class town. She had had servants. I think certainly that was a problem, at least at the beginning.
Did she try to keep Lincoln from associating with his own family?
There's not any real evidence of that. There is a question that has actually haunted me the entire time that I was telling this story, and I never have been able to come up with a really good answer for it. That is the fact that Lincoln never permitted his children to visit his own parents. Although they spent a lot of time with Mary's parents, they never, ever visited Lincoln's parents.
And he had been quite fond of his father and his stepmother.
Beg your pardon?
He himself was personally very fond of his father and even of his stepmother.
I think he was fond of his stepmother. As far as I know, there was a great deal of tension between Lincoln and his father, and I'm not really sure why that was. My book does have certain parameters, and it begins and ends with the marriage, and what went on between Thomas Lincoln, Lincoln's father, and him is sort of out of my purview.
So we're not quite sure why the boys didn't ever see their grandparents.
It might have been, if I was going to speculate about that, I would say that that this did have something to do with the class consciousness and the fact that Lincoln's parents lived on a farm and lived in, they were not very prosperous. And it's possible that both Lincoln and Mary were a little bit embarrassed about that.
So the Lincoln's second son, Eddie, had been sort of sickly throughout his childhood, but then just before he turned four, he got gravely ill. And you have this very poignant scene of Mary Lincoln literally pulling out her hair, worrying about him.
Yes, that was one of those details that I found in an interview with that was done in the 19th century, and I was so struck by that because I had never heard that particular detail before, and people often ask me, how do you recreate the emotions and the thoughts of these people as they were going through experiences like this so many years ago, and that was the kind of detail that I thought brought so vividly to life Mary Lincoln's anguish, the fact that she would pull a single hair at a time out of her head.
It is hard, I guess, once again, not to go back and sort of pathologize now that we know that's a condition that is linked to other kinds of mental illness. Did you find yourself having to fight against then looking for eight other symptoms that would match up with something that we know today?
No, I didn't have any problem with that at all. Mm-hmm. I'd read a good deal of the literature about Lincoln being depressed, and it's very obvious for anybody who reads the life of Mary Lincoln that her highs were very highs, were very high, and her lows were very low, and her own contemporaries identified that. But I tried to exercise great discipline in working from moment to moment, hour to hour, week to week, with these people, talking about their behavior, talking about what they did, so that the reader can get a picture of the extent to which they're depressed or elated or manic. I think that's something that's best left to the reader.
Daniel Mark Epstein is my guest. His new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. We'll take a quick break and then return to the conversation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biographer Daniel Mark Epstein. His new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. There is distinct evidence that you found that Mary Todd Lincoln's temper could get the best of her at times with her husband.
That's right. I had there were a few wonderful moments in doing the research for this book. It's always exciting to find something that's really new. And there had been a lot of anecdotal evidence over the years, gossip, rumors, that Mary Lincoln from time to time was physically abusive of her husband, chased him around with a broom, poured a bucket of water on his head when he came home late one night. But no real hard evidence of this. And I got particularly interested in the story that that occurred in 1857, a few years before they went to Washington, when Mary was supposed to have hit her husband in the face with a stick of firewood. Now, a little bit of background on the story. Supposedly, it was in the dead of winter. It was very cold, and Mary Lincoln asked her husband to make the fire, and he was wool gathering, as he was wont to do, not paying attention. And he didn't hear her, and so she asked him again. And the third time she said, Mr. Lincoln, I'm going to make you hear me this time. And she picked up a piece of firewood and whacked him across the face with it and bruised his nose pretty badly. Now, there were two sources of information for this, and each of them in their way unreliable. One was William Herndon, who was Abraham Lincoln's law partner, and just happened to hate Mary Lincoln. So that was a little bit suspicious, but he did give a date. He gave a date for this occurrence. And then there was a second source, which is what a biographer wants, which was a maid who was working in the house who says that she witnessed this event. But I wanted something more in order to really establish this. And I discovered a receipt, a store receipt, for the exact date that that Herndon mentions, for a gelatin plaster that, on the exact date mentioned by Lincoln's law partner, Lincoln purchased for the bandage that everybody saw on his nose. So raising a piece of historical information from the level of anecdote to fact is the kind of thing that historians really pray might happen once in a while. So that was one of those aha moments in writing this book.
Well, you know, Daniel, it's so extraordinary, I would think, even as a historian, to think that something that today, a scrap that would be considered completely insignificant, could prove so important.
Well, you never know. You never know. And just as exciting, really, was this discovery of, you know, by going through old letters that other historians had looked at, but they just hadn't really paid attention to what was there. One of the really exciting moments for me was discover at the Library of Congress in a collection called the Harriet Lane Papers. Now, Harriet Lane was the niece of Buchanan, who was Lincoln's predecessor in the White House. Anyway, in her somebody working on a book on Lincoln might not necessarily go and look at the Harriet Lane papers, but I just happened to be doing that one day, and I found a letter from a doctor who was in the White House when shortly after Mrs. Lincoln arrived, and her children got the measles, and the received wisdom about Mrs. Lincoln was that she was such an hysterical woman at this point in her life that she really couldn't take care of an emergency of this sort in her own home with her own children.
That she would have been brought to her knees by any kind of crisis.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And that other people would have to step in and handle it. And in fact, there was a report from one of her relatives on this measles incident who said that she had taken care of the children when they had measles. Anyway, so I find this letter from a doctor who was in the White House at the time, describing Mary Lincoln staying up all night with these children and taking care of them. And the next morning, being too tired to continue, she summons the nurse who's supposed to take over. The day nurse gives her some back talk, Mary Lincoln immediately fires the day nurse and hires somebody new. And it's just such an incredible portrait of a woman who is completely in charge of the situation. You know, this was not somebody who was disabled by an emergency. So that was very exciting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Daniel Mark Epstein. The book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. Let's speak to Marcellus in Dallas. Hi, Marcellus.
Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to comment. I have read in a couple of different places that the problem with, part of the problem, I guess, with Abe Lincoln and his dad was that his dad did not support his educating himself, him reading. He would kind of put him down for, you know, singing him under a tree with a book. And he also used to hire him out to other farmers. So I think that that was a difficult situation. I think that with Abe Lincoln being the most sensitive guy that he was, maybe he didn't want to expose his children to the harshness or the reality of what that was. But that was just my comment.
Thanks
Thank you very much. No one can know everything about Lincoln. And I've concentrated on the marriage, the years of the marriage, and it's really helpful to have other people step in areas where that I haven't been able to cover.
What do we know? The Lincolns were sort of famous for letting their children run amok, and you have a wonderful scene in there that speaks to why that may have been the case.
Well, I know that the philosophy that the Lincolns had after they went to the White House was let the children have a good time. It was a very dark time in American history. The White House was not home to them. You know, they'd lived in Springfield all their lives, and they really made every effort to let the children go when they were in the White House and to spoil them. Really, I mean, they gave them wonderful toys and ponies and so on. So that was certainly that was a period of indulgence of the children because it wasn't a time to try to impress really firm discipline on them. Were you thinking of another part of the story?
Well, I remember early on there was an issue of a discussion over whether they should start disciplining the children or not, and Abe thought it was time to start sort of teaching them manners, and Mary stepped in.
Yes. Actually, that was reported by Harriet Hanks. I believe Harriet Hanks was that was the cousin who was staying with them at the time, and two of the children were quite it was Bobby, who maybe had been 2 or 3 years old. And we're not sure exactly what Bobby did. Maybe he pulled the cat's tail. Maybe he tried to run in the fireplace. But Lincoln decided that it was time to take the strap to him, which is what people did in those days. Of course, we don't do that now. But his wife objected, and they had quite an argument over it. But Lincoln got his way, and he insisted on disciplining the child. So that runs counter to the received, the received wisdom that these were totally indulgent parents.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that you think that everyone that when we look at the Lincoln's marriage, despite people's thoughts about Abe Lincoln being depressed, that he always comes across as the one who was sort of the long suffering partner in the whole thing?
Well, this has to do with stereotypes that go way way back, and most of what people know about the marriage is the White House years. The abundance of evidence has been about the White House years and what went on then. And the fact is, that was the worst time of their marriage. And Mary, having lived in a small town for her whole life, was suddenly thrust into this, the crucible of the White House during the Civil War. And she really became destabilized. She became destabilized, and the marriage became destabilized. She moved in a world that she created of her own coterie. A lot of sycophants who wanted favors from her. She was obsessed with redecorating the White House. She worked very hard on that. Actually, did a pretty good job too. While Lincoln was living in this world of generals and politicians and so on, so the marriage that had thrived on that delicate balance between the two of them and they're being together for very intense periods of time and his being away on the road, suddenly everything was upset, and she actually saw much, much less of him when they were together in the White House than she did when they were in Springfield.
She was criticized for spending money on the decorating. She was criticized for throwing parties, including one that took place even after her son Willie was quite ill. And in fact, I found it to be very moving because you have this scene of her trying to throw this lavish party and running back upstairs to where her child is lying in bed, essentially dying of typhoid.
It's really one of the most tragic scenes in the history of the marriage. And the social situation was, here's the situation. Mary Lincoln decided that she did not want to have any more state dinners, and that was the mode of operation of the White House socially in those days. They had a number of state dinners were limited. Dignitaries were invited to each dinner. That was one part of the social scene. The other part of the traditional social scene were these open houses. They called them levees, and anybody could go to these huge parties. And they had them on New Year's. They had them a couple of other times a year, and they were just mob scenes. Well, Mary decided to do a large party, neither a state dinner nor an open house. She decided to do a large party where they would invite 500 people by invitation. And this, of course, caused incredible controversy in Washington because the people who were invited, of course, were delighted to be invited, but the people who were excluded, and of course a lot more had to be excluded, were furious, absolutely furious at her. So she was very, very heavily criticized for that party. People said that Mrs. Lincoln is having a ball when the soldiers are starving and they don't have blankets and so on. All of that was going on. That criticism of Mary Lincoln was going on at the time that her son was lay dying from typhoid, which is a very, very painful way to go.
And he was, essentially, at first they thought he was going to be okay, and there would be these moments where he would sort of revive, and then he would get worse again.
That was the nature of the disease. Actually, they called it typhoid, they called it intermittent bilious fever because it was intermittent, and the doctors, one day Willie would be up and drawing and reading and he would look like he was getting better, and then he would get worse. So it was a real roller coaster for the Lincolns while Willie was dying.
The other thing that's really extraordinary about this is that, as you write it, Mary Lincoln would take care of Willie for hours on end, but Abraham Lincoln was there as well. When Willie was up and conscious, he tried to be at his son's side as much as possible.
It is remarkable when you think of the responsibilities that Lincoln had at the time. If you look at his schedule, which is quite well documented, and the press of office seekers, politicians, generals, all of whom were crowding into his office, but he would walk down the hall to where his son was lying sick and spend hours with him there. Yeah, he really was. He was a large-spirited man.
And then after Willie died, Mary did seem to sort of fall apart. And Lincoln, on the other hand, gave himself, it sounds like, an hour a week to grieve very openly. And then he would sort of go back to what he had to do. And I wonder about, how that ability to compartmentalize really played itself out throughout his professional career and his personal life.
Well, he did have marvelous control over his emotions. And his mind. I may be saying the wrong thing in saying he had marvelous control over his emotions, because this is a man who could weep openly. He had an hysterical sense of humor. Sometimes he would get the giggles, like a kid would, and people couldn't stop him. but on the other hand, he did have remarkable powers of concentration. I think that's really the word. He would concentrate on his grieving for Willie, just as you said, one day a week. The Tuesday, that was the day that his son died. He would go into the room for an hour in the middle of the day. He would weep. He would grieve. He would be with his emotions, and then he'd go right back into the office and go back to work. I mean, that really is, I think that's one of the keys to Lincoln's success.
Was he unable then to empathize with the way that Mary dealt with Willie's death?
Oh, I think he was marvelously empathetic. Mm-hmm. And he spent a great deal of time with her when she was grieving. And he also, there's a lot of correspondence in this book. I talk about the fact that he made such a great effort to get relatives to come and stay with Mary, to get nurses and friends to come in and spend time with her, because she was really isolated in her grief. But he did his best, really, to spend time with her and to try to bring her out of that that terrible depression. There's just no other word for it.
But after a while, even her own sister couldn't take it anymore.
That's right. That's right. And we have all of those extraordinary letters of her sister describing how completely out of control Mary Lincoln was in her grief, how she had to be restrained.
Yeah, and at that point she started having what appeared to be episodes of psychosis.
Yes. One of her cousins describes a visit to Mary. This is about a year after Willie died, and it's really quite a wonderful scene. In the middle of the night, her sister Emily is talking to Mary, and Mary says that Willie is still visible to her, that he comes to her bedside at night and appears, and that's certainly a hallucination if there ever was one.
Mm-hmm. My guest is biographer Daniel Mark Epstein. His new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can join us via email to think@kera.org. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biographer Daniel Mark Epstein. His new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Daniel, I know that you don't ever want to put thoughts in people's heads that you don't know existed, but you do go so far as to know in great detail the physical locations where these people spent their time, what the furniture looked like, what the weather was outside on a particular date. Can you talk about how that plays into what you're writing?
Yes, it's a wonderful question about method, because people are asking me from time to time, you know, how do you know what these people were feeling? How do you know what they were going through? And the technique really has to do with working from the outside in. And before I started writing this book, I went to Springfield, Illinois. I walked the streets. I saw the light. I saw how the shadows fell. I studied maps in detail so that I knew where everybody lived. And you work really, if you know, for instance, as an example, if you know that these people went to Niagara Falls in 1855, if you can actually recreate what Niagara Falls looked like at that time, and you know which hotel they were in, then you have a shared experience that you can talk about in a very, very romantic environment. And that's of course, a very romantic period of their life, and I wanted to recreate that. So I have this scene in the book of the two of them witnessing certain things at Niagara Falls. And that's how detail plays into things. There's an often told story of the night that Lincoln after Lincoln broke up with Mary Todd in 1841, he went crazy, and his roommate said that he had to hide the razors and the knives, and there was a real suicide watch for Lincoln. And by using an almanac, I was able to find out that the moon was full that night. Hmm. Well, that's a detail that it makes a lovely part of the picture that I've never seen in any other book about Lincoln. So a lot of what I do, as I say, is really the slow gathering of details, so that you can almost get a sense of what the people are thinking and feeling by what they're observing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Tricia in Dallas. Hi, Tricia.
Hi. I have a question for you. I had, during Mary Todd's unstable time as Mrs. Lincoln, I had heard or read years ago that she was heavily medicated and that they were alluding to the fact that this medication was causing her to be unstable or create these hallucinations. Is there any truth to that?
I think it's quite possible. After Willie Lincoln died, she certainly was heavily medicated, and I suppose they used opiates, some of which could have hallucinogenic effects. We don't really have we don't have the receipts for those things. So we can't tell for sure, but I think that's a very sound premise.
And she also she tried to find mediums and people who would help her connect to Willie. Is that right?
She did, and that interest in spiritualism that continued for the rest of her life. At that time, that way of dealing with death and mourning was much more common than it is now. One of her best friends, Dr. Anson Henry, who also had been Lincoln's doctor for many, many years, he visited after Willie died, and he actually encouraged her to seek the solace of spirit mediums.
The Lincolns were at no time unaware of the threat of assassination. Can you talk about how that played into their relationship?
Oh, heavily, heavily. I think one of the things that makes this story very, very suspenseful has to do with the change in their life from the Springfield days to the White House days. And from the time they got on that train from Springfield to Washington in 1861, they were under constant threat of assassination. Many people have heard the story of the assassination attempt in Baltimore. The train was nearing Washington. In Philadelphia, they got news that that there was a plan to assassinate Lincoln in Baltimore. So Lincoln got on a secret train. He left his family. On the other train, he got on a secret train which took him into Baltimore, through Baltimore, under cover of night, and he got into Washington very smoothly. But in the meantime, you know who was left on that train, that decoy train?
His
Mary
wife and
Lincoln
kids.
And her children. So for the first time, Lincoln was more important than the rest of his family. He was president. And anyway, the threat of assassination, the terror of assassination haunted the White House the whole time they were there. And Lincoln's response to that was to say, I'm not going to live in fear. And he didn't. He lived in denial about it. And the less he worried about it, the more she did. Mm-hmm. So this put a tremendous stress on her.
He did have some really disturbing dreams that would seem to portend some sort of violent end to his life.
Yes, he had He was a man who believed in dreams and portents, and there are two very famous incidents. One is after his first election, he was lying on a couch, and he looked up in a mirror. He lifted his head, he looked in the mirror, and he saw two images of himself, one right next to the other, and one was very clear, and the other was very vague. And he and his wife talked about this, and his wife said, she was the one who interpreted the dream, I believe. She said she feared that that would mean that he would be elected to a second term, but he wouldn't serve it out. So that's one dream. Mm-hmm. The other dream that's really spooky is he dreamed a few weeks before his death. He was on the front, the military front, and he had a dream one night that he woke up in the White House and he heard sobs, and he went down the stairs and he asked, "What's the matter? Why is everybody crying?" And the answer was, "The president has been shot."
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Brent in Dallas. Hi, Brent.
Hello. I was wondering, I know I just got in toward the latter part of the show. I understand the book is about
the marriage
of relationship with his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But I was wondering if the author had any information regarding Lincoln's relationship with Joshua Speed, his roommate for years during his young lawyer years.
Yes.
I know
yes.
many of those letters are missing.
Well,
they were very intimate correspondence.
It's a wonderful correspondence. It's probably it's my favorite part of the correspondence of Abraham Lincoln. And I don't know, there are some of them are missing, but most of them are there. And you really get the sense that these two men were very, very good friends. Several years ago, there was a book about that suggested that these two men were had a homoerotic relationship, and I think that if you read those letters between Speed and Lincoln, you see that there is really no trace at all of homoeroticism in those letters. They're talking about love. They're talking about each of them is talking about his own experience with women and engagements. Speed's engagement with Fanny Speed, Lincoln's engagement with Mary Todd, they're advising each other, and they're talking about love in the most idealistic terms. So it really was a marvelous friendship.
Do you think the misinterpretation, if that's what it is, of the relationship between Lincoln and Joshua Speed has to do with the fact that heterosexual men were able to express affection to each other in really different ways than are acceptable today between heterosexual male friends?
I think that's true. I think that's true. Also, this has been mentioned perhaps much too often, but Lincoln and Speed shared a bed up above Joshua Speed's grocery store. Now, in those days, that was not considered. It wasn't assumed that two men who shared a bed were lovers. In this day and age, it is. What most people don't realize is that in that same room with Speed and Lincoln were two other men. Billy Herndon was one of them, and the four of them all lived up there. And Billy Herndon was studying Lincoln, you know, with microscopic intensity, and he never mentions anything. He never mentions anything at all unusual about the fact that Speed and Lincoln slept in the same bed.
Is there anything, Daniel, that you can take from what you've learned about the relationship of Mary Todd Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln and sort of extrapolate it to help interpret the relationships of presidents today or presidential candidates? Can you apply it, or is every single presidential marriage so different that there's no point in even trying?
Well, they're all different, but there are two things that I came away with. One is that these two people were so devoted to each other. And I think that any marriage, whether you're married to somebody who's going to become president or you're married to somebody who's going to become a cobbler or a lawyer, you do have to have that sense of devotion that you're going to see things to the end. And I think the best political marriages are like that. I think of Eleanor Roosevelt and FDR, a perfect match, and she did so much for him. I think of Jackie Kennedy and the way that she... she made of Washington a cultural center. She made the White House into a showplace. Mary Lincoln did the same thing. She was sort of the Jackie Kennedy of her day. I think there are different ways that political spouses can support their husbands, and they've all done it in different ways. Michelle Obama, I think, is wonderful in keeping her husband grounded in his family. She doesn't want him to forget that he has a life apart from being a presidential candidate. So, there are a lot of different ways that people can help each other political spouses and spouses in general.
Are there qualities in Michelle Obama you think that will get misinterpreted or unfairly interpreted?
I don't know. I mean, I think she's very outspoken, but she's very clear. She's very smart. I think that she will make herself clear. She'll make herself known, and she'll make herself clear.
Was Abraham Lincoln a good husband?
Oh my, that's a big question. Mm-hmm. I think that yes. I mean, he was certainly devoted, as I said. His wife said that she could have loved him better if he had stayed home more, which is sort of ironic when you consider the fact that he had to be out on the road to make money, and he had to be out on the road to become president, and of course she wanted him to be president more than anybody could imagine. I think his greatest flaw as a president was his abstraction. He was maddeningly self-absorbed, and there were times that he was just inaccessible, like the story that you've heard about her hitting him in the face with a piece of wood.
He was just there in his head, basically.
Right. His attention wandered.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think would be, I mean, it's so hard to apply. There have been people who've said that there'd be no way that someone like Abraham Lincoln with a funny voice and a strange look would be elected today. Do you think that's nonsense? Do you think that sort of talent would shine through even in our media culture?
Oh, I really do. Mm-hmm. I really do. If you read, if you read my book, you'll get a sense of this man's charisma. By the time he was running for the Senate against Stephen Douglas, who also was a man of considerable charisma, there are a number of descriptions of the way the crowds behaved when they saw Lincoln. I mean, they just went nuts. He had extraordinary charisma, and he was fascinating. He was a great storyteller. He was a great. You talk about his funny voice. Actually, his voice was charming. It was very musical. He could hold a crowd for 2-3 hours with a single speech.
And certainly knew whether they wanted him to be Lincoln the goofy country boy or Lincoln the sophisticate.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. You asked earlier a very good question, you know, about everybody knew him, nobody knew him. There was something about Lincoln that was, he did cultivate mystery. He did have a sense of, I think of mystery as being a dimension of romance. And this is a man who began life as an idealist and a romantic and turned into a hard-boiled realist. But anyway, that, I thought that was a very good question that you raised.
Thank you. Daniel Mark Epstein's new book is called The Lincolns, Portrait of a Marriage. Daniel, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.